change research and justice, a new lecture series brought to you by CKUT 90.3 FM, the McGill Office of Sustainability, and Climate Justice Montreal. This event is the first of a year-long series of lectures to take place here at McGill University and live on CKUT's airwaves that seeks to answer these questions, spark discussions, and put actions into motion. Each month, our aim is to bring to the forefront key players in climate change research and activism from within the McGill, Montreal, and global communities. Throughout the year, we will bring you lectures that break down the key concepts of climate change and inspire us to work towards a sustainable future. These lectures are and will be broadcasted live on CKUT 90.3 FM and online at ckut.ca, and will be compiled and distributed in a podcast format at the end of each term, in hopes that the collection of lectures from throughout the year will comprise an audible course on climate change, free and available to anyone, anywhere in the world. To find out more about the project, you can come see me at the end of this lecture or check out undertheweather.ckut.ca. Tonight, we are thrilled to have filmmaker and social and climate justice activist Amy Miller here to kick off this new series. Following her lecture, we will have a question and answer session. I'm going to start things off by inviting Laurel Thompson to the microphone, who will be introducing Amy. Laurel recently moved to Montreal from Colorado, where she was a college and early childhood teacher, a labor organizer, and an environmental activist. In Denver, she helped in the founding of several groups. In 1990, she started Citizens for Balanced Transportation to get better mass transit and accommodate pedestrians and bicyclists in a city where 95% of the travel was by car. She advocated for childcare workers, who are one of the most underpaid, underrespected groups of workers in the U.S., and she also assisted in the formation of the Denver Green Party. Here in Montreal, she is a volunteer with the Citizens Climate Lobby, which is dedicated to getting a revenue-neutral federal carbon tax for both here and the U.S. She is also active in Climate Justice Montreal, which is committed to stopping the transport of oil throughout Quebec. She also writes philosophy. Please welcome Laurel Thompson.
Hi, my name is Laurel, and as she said, I'm a volunteer with Climate Justice Montreal, a grassroots organization that pursues climate justice through education, mobilization, and community collective action in solidarity with communities that are directly affected by climate change. Our home is Sustainable Concordia, and we meet weekly to discuss events and strategize. We're currently trying to get the Montreal City Council to pass a resolution forbidding all transport of oil through Montreal, either by pipeline or by train. When Irene asked me to welcome Amy Miller on this as the first speaker for Under the Weather, I said, right, I'd like to do that. I first saw Amy Miller when Carbon Rush was first presented last year here in Montreal, and I was impressed with her prescience in tracking down problems with the emissions trading system that the EU has designed to control carbon dioxide emissions. I don't believe in offsets. I believe a carbon tax is better than cap and trade, so I was interested in any proof that emission trading does not work. But even I was shocked by some of the scams that are going on with the European system and Miller's images. Garbage dumps in India, unwanted eucalyptus forests in Brazil, hydroelectric dams in Panama. Exposing the truth behind public claims of fairness and satisfaction is the kind of thing Miller likes to do. Her first documentary was about EU immigration policy and the pressures on the countries surrounding Europe to handle detainees. She provided footage of a detention center in the Ukraine that no one had ever visited before with a camera. She then made another film about Canada's real foreign policy as opposed to the one it likes to take credit for that's entitled Myths for Profit. All those stories about Canada being a peaceful nation, those sleepy Quebec and Ontario small towns, some of them hide factories that are making weapons systems for use all over the world. For a country that is supposedly interested in defense, we sure have a big weapons industry. Whether it was growing up in Sudbury and seeing the devastation caused by uranium mining, or just because she has a good nose for hypocrisy, Amy seems to gravitate towards deception. Like any good documentary filmmaker, she looks for places no one else is visiting, stories no one else is telling, voices no one else is listening to. However, she is not just interested in aiming her camera at things that are concealed. She's also an activist. Working as a journalist at the 2010 G20 protest in Toronto, she was detained for investigating an incident between the police and young people on Bay Street. Next thing she knew, she was put in custody for 13 hours along with about 25 other women. Afterwards, Miller told the press about those nice Toronto policemen. The women were scorned, threatened with rape, and told that certain things would be done to them that they would never make them want to protest again. Some of them were strip-searched and sexually assaulted. Maria Morani, Bloc Québécois deputy leader for Hunsick and a strong advocate for women, used Miller's words when she testified before the hearing on public safety and national security in the House of Commons. This was not the first time that Amy went up against the law. A few years earlier, in 2002, she participated in what became known as the 7-year squat, which is to say the occupation of a privately owned building in Ottawa to protest the failure for 7 years to provide subsidized housing for families in need. Police came after them with tear gas, and the group of five was eventually evicted. But when they were arraigned before the judge, Miller and the others mounted their own defense during a 10-week trial using sophisticated legal arguments. Each had 8 criminal charges against them, and they won. This is not a woman who says takes no for an answer. How effective is her courage and outspokenness? It's interesting that now, 1 year after the Carbon Rush was released, NGOs in Europe are telling the EU not to try to fix the emissions trading system, which they want to do because it's a mess, but to drop it all together and guess what? Just start cutting emissions. They say emissions in Europe increased sharply in 2010 and 2011 on account of the offsets because 1/3 to 2/3 of the projects designed to achieve carbon credits did not actually represent reductions. Could Miller's film have helped to galvanize European activists to push their case? There's a good chance that it did. As The Economist said recently, the emissions trading system has long been dysfunctional because there are too many allowances and the price for carbon permits is too low. When you factor in the charade of offsets that Miller's film revealed, it becomes clear that lobbyists for the big MEPs have created a system to fight global warming that basically allows them to continue business as usual. NGOs want to see that change. Miller is obviously not shy about taking on the biggest issues of our time. She's identified some of the key problems with our corporate-dominated economy, its vast inequalities, its exploitation of the environment and people in the third world, and its sexism. Her latest film is called No Land, No Food, No Life, and is about the looming food insecurity as corporations compete with subsistence farmers to purchase arable land with access to water. It opens in Vancouver on October the 3rd. The key to her work is exposure. By showing people the actual consequences of stated policy goals, whether they be those of governments or corporations, Miller shines the light on the huge disconnect between language and reality that ripples through our world. Highfalutin sounding objectives and goals, but failure and inequality on the ground. Pretended sympathy and concern dispensed to the home audience here in Canada, but out in the field, the story is very different. Weapons manufacturing, pursuit of profit. I hope she continues to educate us about the real effect of our actions on the world, because maybe it will make us insist that our leaders be more honest, or better still, make us get off our duffs and do something. We are obviously not getting much help from mainstream media. When corporations rule the world, we see what they want us to see, and most of the time it is pretty selective and one-sided. It's better with the internet because we can communicate directly with people across the world, though who knows how long that will last. For this reason and others, we need more documentary filmmakers like Amy Miller who are not afraid to go out on their own and find the truth.
Thank you so much, Laurel, for such a beautiful introduction. And thank you so much for coming this evening. Thank you so much, CQET, for inviting me. I'd like to start by acknowledging the land we're on today and giving thanks to Mother Earth and acknowledging the Mohawk land we're on. I got into documentary filmmaking back in 2007 after being a union organizer and a community organizer. I had been involved in social justice organizing for many years, and I decided to make the switch into documentary filmmaking because where I was at in my life in 2006 was one where I was an organizer with a group called Block the Empire here in Montreal that was trying to do critical work around Canada's involvement in the military-industrial complex and occupation and imperialism around the world. At the time when I was organizing with Block the Empire, we didn't really have many tools out there to bring forward that analysis. I had looked for different videos. This was 2006, so YouTube was starting to become more popular and something people could access. But there really wasn't any videos out there that would bring forward an analysis of how Canada was profiting off war. And so essentially we were organizing with some leaflets and, you know, some slogans, but not that much else out there. There was a couple people doing research, but in terms of a tool where we can agitate and educate with, we were pretty limited. And I realized, you know, there should be some sort of documentary that organizers can use and do workshops with that, you know, we can that would build our movements. And for me, that was the main driving reason on why I thought it would be important to start making documentaries, because I didn't see myself as someone that would be outside of social justice and climate justice movements, but someone that was already involved and identified as being part of. And so the tools I wanted to make would be furthering our movements so that we could use them so that they can grow. Because I truly believe that documentary has the capacity to educate and transform people, because when people learn about a situation, then they can act and they can make informed decisions that I hope can transform our societies. When I started making documentaries, for me, it was about saying, okay, well, we have to get to the root cause of issues. We need to actually tackle what is behind what's happening in the world. And so with the carbon rush, for me, it was really important to look at the market mechanism that's being used right now as the so-called main solution to deal with climate change. And that's the carbon market that works under the Kyoto Protocol that the United Nations set up. And when I'm talking about root causes, I'm talking about what are the structural elements in our societies. So I'm talking about our political systems. I'm talking about our economic systems. And so here in North America, I argue that it's a politics of that are entrenched in colonialism and expansion, and it's an economic system of capitalism and ever-expanding resource extraction. And then when we look around at different documentaries that exist that deal with climate change, there's some really great popular documentaries, so say like An Inconvenient Truth or The Age of Stupid. But those documentaries, despite how well-made they are and how popular they've become, they really stay within the liberal consensus. So instead of challenging head-on and saying, well, wait a minute, what is at the root of the problem that's leading to climate change? Oh, it's capitalism that requires us to continue to consume and continuously extract our resources, and that's based on colonialism. No, instead, it takes a liberal consensus view that says we can continue to live in this society with capitalism. We just need to have a little bit of fine-tuning. You know, we can have our cake and eat it too. All we need to do is maybe change our light bulbs. Maybe we just need to get a better dryer, you know, and start using the clothes hanger, and more or less, it'll be fine. And so for me, it was really important with the carbon rush to say, well, what's actually the root causes, and explore that. And so the carbon rush looks at the carbon market. And the carbon market, for those of you who aren't aware, is essentially a system that was set up where one ton of carbon is the equivalent of one carbon credit. And so you can purchase a carbon credit for one, which is the equivalent of one ton, and that carbon credit can be used then for projects that are called carbon offset projects. And these are projects that are designed and set up in the global south where they're going to supposedly do something that is green, and so where companies in the global north can continue to pollute, and all they have to do then is say, for this amount of carbon that we're going to pollute, we're going to buy the equivalent of carbon credits, what are then going to be used for these projects somewhere else in the world so that we can continue to function as normal. So the way I always like to explain it in layman's turn is kind of the shell game. So you remember the game where people would have a bead and there would be three shells and then the shell would move around? But the bead is always still underneath the shell. It's just a magician trick that gives you the illusion that it's disappeared, but it actually hasn't. And so that's how I kind of see the carbon market, where we're not actually reducing any carbon. What we're doing is saying that somewhere else it's going to be dealt with because there's some green project. Whether or not it's actually verified, whether or not it actually does anything good for the environment, that's secondary. We're going to say it does, and we're going to get it certified, and then we can make lots of money. Because that's what we've seen with the carbon market. There's many investors that have made millions of dollars, all under this auspice that this is the main solution that's going to lead us to having a climate that's safe for future generations. We can see now that we haven't actually seen any real emissions reductions. What we have seen with the carbon market is that the impacts that these projects have on the people who live on the ground with them have had real devastating consequences, and both on an environmental level but also on a social level. So maybe at this point, I'm going to just say that I strongly argue that the carbon market is doing more harm than good environmentally and socially, and that it should be scrapped completely, and that we need to start moving forward with solutions that tackle the real root causes that have brought us to this mess in the first place. I'm going to go through a few of the examples that are explored in the film for the listeners out there and here who haven't had a chance to see the film. The first example that we see is in Minas Gerais in Brazil, and it's eucalyptus plantations. So Minas Gerais had been a region that had a lot of dairy production and a lot of different agricultural practices happening. And then about 10 years ago, a lot of this region was transformed to be massive eucalyptus plantations that were certified to become carbon offset projects. Now, the thing is with eucalyptus is, while it may suck carbon while it's, you know, there, so these eucalyptus plantations, they're getting chopped down, and the carbon, the charcoal, they're getting converted into charcoal, and then this charcoal is being burned in these massive, like, charcoal burners that gets turned into steel, which then gets turned into cars that are then sold back to the people in Minas Gerais. So that's the full life cycle of what happens with these eucalyptus plantations. And it's not just here, it's not these particular eucalyptus plantations. It's essentially everywhere where there's eucalyptus, they get used for the charcoal that can be used from the eucalyptus trees. And on top of that, in terms of what actually is the life cycle of the eucalyptus trees and these plantations, it takes a tremendous amount of pesticides to grow these eucalyptus trees, which destroys the water sources in the area and has really made it more or less impossible for these people who were farmers before to continue their ways of life. So I think it's pretty easy for people to see the absurdity of a carbon credit being for a project that's supposed to be green when we're talking about trees getting cut down to then be turned into charcoal, to be turned into steel, that are turned into cars that we all know are very much polluting the planet. So that's an easy example to show the absurdity of the market. When we move forward in the film, another example is that in Maharashtra in India with the windmills. Now, these are incredibly poor people who are subsistence-based farmers, many of them who are illiterate and uneducated, the mass majority of them. And for all intents and purposes, in the villages that I had visited, it was the same story that was repeating themselves, of that people had essentially been tricked, and they had been promised many things, and they had been signed, you know, they signed with their fingerprints contracts that were going to promise them schools for their children, a health care for the first time in the area, actually accessible roads, quotes, you know, and where they were definitely given the impression they were going to continue to be able to farm their land and that this was actually going to be a benefit and that in exchange there was going to be windmills that were going to be put on their, you know, a couple of windmills that were going to be put on their land and that this was going to help save the planet. That's how it was explained to them. Unfortunately, what was the reality that I saw and the testimonies that I got from folks was that their land was stolen from them. They got nothing in return, and there were so many windmills put up. We're talking about thousands upon thousands of windmills that it was impossible for people to continue doing farming. Their land wasn't farmable anymore. And so people who, for many generations, hundreds of years now, had been subsistence-based farmers were dispossessed of their land and displaced. And this common idea, or that commonality of people being displaced from the land, was something that was coming up a lot when I was visiting people and talking to them about the impact of the offset projects that were happening. The irony of the windmills in Maharashtra is that it was the main purchaser of that carbon offset with the credits is for a Norwegian shopping mall. To be able to continue, and that's their offset. The next example in the film that I want to talk about is one that really resonates with a lot of people and that audience members have often come up to me and said, wow, when I saw the example of the refuse to arrive fuel in India with the waste pickers, you know, it really got to me about how ridiculous of a system this is. And the reason being is that the offsets in this example are RDF, which is refuse derived fuel. And for those of you who are unaware, this is when we have plastic that's combined with organic waste that's compacted, and then it's burned in incinerators. And so the compacting of the waste with the plastic is the RDF is an offset itself. And then the incineration of it, as opposed to using another source of power, is considered a carbon offset. So despite the fact that you're burning plastics with tons of other carcinogenics that are going into the air and that where it like leads to serious, you know, respiratory problems, this is a carbon offset because, you know, we're burning garbage. So somehow the logic is there that this is, you know, reducing carbon emissions. But the reality is in India, you have a huge sector of the population that make their livelihood from the recycling sector. And it's much more advanced than anything we see here in North America, where they have their cardboard getting sorted, their plastics, you know, all kinds of different things that people will go and pick through because there's a consignment and there's a whole recycling sector. And it's not a glamorous life. It's definitely one of the lowest sectors of society in India. But there are literally thousands of people that make their livelihood from this, and they do it with dignity. And all of this sector of society has now been displaced because they've made it very difficult now to do any of the recycling because that waste now is being transferred now to the RDF factories to turn into the RDF that's used in incinerators. And I think when we look at elements of justice in terms of, well, who is the carbon market serving, it's certainly not serving the waste pickers in India who, should there be some benefactors from the carbon market, I would argue that it is the farmers and the waste pickers who are doing the most to reduce emissions that should be benefited from it. But in fact, that's not what's happening at all. The last example I was hoping to discuss in the film is the one that closes off the film, and this is in Honduras with a biogas recovery system. In the film, I don't really look at what the biogas recovery system is because for me, that's very secondary. What I'm more interested in showing in this example is the human rights abuses that can come because, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum. Honduras is a country that had a coup d'etat in 2009, and Miguel Facuse is one of the wealthiest and most powerful people in the country. He is one of the largest landowners, and his money has come very much so from the cultivation of palm oil. There's been major land disputes happening all over Honduras, as well as all over Central America. And the example that I wanted to show was how Miguel Facuse, this extremely wealthy, powerful man, who has a huge plantation for the cultivation of palm oil, where his biogas recovery system is. There's been a conflict with the land, where there are many farmers who are trying to reclaim the land that has been stolen from them. There's been dozens of human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, who have done fact-finding missions that have shown that, as it is, there's been over 60 people who have been killed now in these conflicts, and it's very much linked directly to the hitmen, to the hired paramilitary that Miguel Facuse operates. The link is very clear. There's tons of evidence. It's been well documented. It's been brought to the United Nations. There's been campaigns saying you have to revoke the carbon credits for this man from his company, because on this land people are getting murdered, and yet the UN has wiped their hands and said, it's not our problem. Because with the carbon market, the logic is that each host country will decide whether or not a project is appropriate and if there's any human rights or social issues that are a concern with the project. But this is where you get the conundrum of, well, what happens with countries where there's no democracy? There's been a coup d'etat, or it's been under a dictatorship and authoritarian rule. Right? Who is to say? Now, while I'm someone that will very much argue that nation states have to have their sovereignty and that they have to have their autonomy and their ability to make decisions, it very much becomes a tricky situation when you're having an international institution like the UN give millions of dollars in carbon credits to a project where we know very clearly that massive human rights violations are going, and it's ongoing. When I've made the film and I had been in Honduras shooting it, there had only been 30 people that had killed. But in just a year and a half since, it's doubled the amount. And it's ongoing, and it's a huge crisis. And Miguel Facuse continues to receive the money from the carbon credits and the offset project there. So I argue that these projects in the carbon market are doing more harm than good, and that more importantly, they're actually reinforcing a colonialist and imperialist dynamic, and that we're not going to see any real solutions to the climate crisis until we address these head on. Usually after my screenings that I have the pleasure to attend, there's a Q&A, and one thing that comes up usually after seeing the film is people say, okay, well, we learned about how horrible this is. You know, what can we do? And I think it's really important to not get bogged down in, how bad of a situation we're living right now, because we all know the climate crisis is serious, it's real, the science is real, we're living it, we need to do something. And I do think there's ways that we can find hope. And I get a lot of hope in the struggles that we're seeing people take on. And one thing I always tell people is the best way to maintain hope is by getting involved and taking on struggle. And so when I say that, what do I mean? Well, I mean one main thing. Here in Canada, I think it means supporting Indigenous struggle. Because wherever polluting and carbon-emitting projects have been halted or delayed, where they've been minimized or regulated, we can definitely thank Indigenous people for their determination in implementing real change. And so one thing I would recommend is people look, Climate Justice Montreal has done a really great job a few years ago of creating a great fact sheet of 10 Indigenous struggles that all climate justice and environmental activists across Canada should support. And if people are looking for a real concrete campaign to take on, well, I think there's no better one than shutting down the tar sands. And that's not one that just affects Indigenous people or the people downstream for the tar sands, but is one that affects us all across the country, and increasingly so, where it's not just a matter of shutting down the tar sands, but also its expansions through the pipelines that are coming right here to Montreal and all across the country. The tar sands, as we know, is the greatest carbon emitter in the world, arguably, certainly here in Canada. And it's a challenging campaign. But I think when people go from a place of hopelessness, but where they start engaging in struggle, well, that's when, hope comes alive and we can actually start transforming our societies. So I'm going to leave the talk there because I feel more comfortable with a more Q&A, and I've already talked quite a bit. So thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to the Q&A.
Thank you for the great talk. I wanted to know, where do you see us in 10 years, if people were really to take your documentaries to heart and to take on these struggles, where do you think we can really go?
Well, I'd like to think that in 10 years, after numerous years of struggle that involves massive economic disruption to the powers that be, we get to a place where our world is more sane and where there's more horizontal decision-making in our societies and where we're looking at creating a world that's just for all. But maybe that's a little idealist. It might be just 10 hard years of struggle.
Say that we're not going to get rid of the climate crisis until we get rid of colonialism. And I hear, at Climate Justice Montreal, I'm much older than most of the other people in this room, and I am definitely old enough to be everybody's grandmother in Climate Justice Montreal. But I hear people say that, you know, how we have to get rid of capitalism. And I think, yeah. But in the meantime, what do we do? I mean, there are steps. I mean, I would like to get rid of capitalism too. But but what do we do in the meantime to get there? And I think it's important to spell out that there are things we can do that are headed towards the goal of a better economic system, but that are really very very sort of mundane and particular and involve actual places and people and organizations right here and right now. And strategizing about that is really interesting and really well worth doing. And it's really kind of wonderful because, it takes you deeply into the world that we are in and makes you see who's got power, who doesn't have power, and you don't fret about the fact that you don't have any power. You get in there and you go after it. You know, you go after the problem. So I guess I'm wondering: do you have any suggestions for how people can conceive getting rid of colonialism? Like using the examples that you had in your film, like the particular things that those people could have done or could do to get rid of those darn wind farms, you know, and those recycling projects that are useless, you know.
Yeah, I thank you for that question. It's a really big one with a lot of ideas in there. So I'm going to start with saying that I really think that anytime we engage in mutual aid, that's an act of resistance towards capitalism. And anytime we decide to work in cooperation in a collective way, that's an act of resistance against capitalism. Our societies are further and further entrenching us into individual, you know, units that try to alienate and, you know, break us away from one another. And just something so simple as like sharing your lunch with someone can be an act of resistance because it goes against everything that the capitalist system wants us to do, which is, you know, spend more money and be individualistic in our consuming patterns. So when we're talking about something more complex on like, well, how do we stop colonialism? I mean, I think it comes with demanding it in our politics, in our way of life. I think the minute we start taking an honest lead in terms of direction from indigenous communities that have been actively working to stop colonialism for a very long time now, then that's when it becomes more of a common understanding or a common language that we're working with, then we're going to start to see more solutions. I truly believe in the innovative and creative capacity of human beings to overcome any struggle. You know, human beings are just incredible in their abilities to continuously invent new wheels. And I think that the solutions will come when we start to actually move forward in our struggles. I feel like there was a tremendous amount of inspiration we could take from the Idle No More movement that happened over the winter, where it was an aha moment for many people to start to bring in an analysis around colonialism. And I think, you know, we've seen from the Arab Spring to the Occupy movements to here in Quebec, we had our student strikes. The politics are, things are moving fast, but the political analysis is also starting to expand, and it's becoming more, I guess, you know, malleable in understanding that we have to have an anti-capitalist and anti-colonialist perspective in our work. And that doesn't mean that we already have the prescription and all of the, you know, ideas all laid out. But we have to start from that. That has to be our starting point, where we're looking at the root causes and actively working to fight them, rather than, you know, throw over and say, oh, well, this is the world we live in and we can't really change it. Because I think that mentality, which I would say is from the older generation or a previous generation, you know, is part and parcel to what the mess is. It's just kind of saying, well, you know, there's not much we can really do. It's beyond our means. When we actively start to say that the power of people coming together can create change, and when we do it in ways that are less than passive, so when we decide to do economic disruptions, when we decide to start doing blockades, when we start to put our bodies on the line, then, you know, power does listen because it disrupts them. And so I always think we have to, you know, look at what our actual goals are and be realistic that I'm very hesitant to say that, you know, a petition is going to be what stops climate chaos, that it's going to take a lot more. And I do think that, you know, people are having a greater sense of the urgency and that, you know, it'll take a lot more than signing the petition, that we're going to have to put our bodies on our line. And it doesn't mean that there isn't room for everyone to get involved within their own comfort zones, because that's the beauty of struggle. There really is room for everyone to get involved in different capacities. But I definitely think it will require everyone to get involved in one way or another. And from that, the solutions will come.
And things are coming down in Quebec in a way that is really amazing. I mean, it's outlandish what's happening. The Energy East pipeline of TransCanada wants to come through here with 1.1 million barrels of oil a day. And Enbridge Line 9B wants to come through here with 300,000 barrels a day. Do you realize what that means? I mean, that amount of oil being transported through this province is too much. I mean, the accidents that could occur are horrendous. And I mean that means they are already bringing through 47 times more oil on trains than they did a few years ago. Which means that there could, in fact, actually be oil on trains coming through Montreal right now. We don't know. We need to find that out. But if that's happening, that means that Megantic could happen here. We are really vulnerable in Quebec, but we're also in a really good position too because Energy East is coming through and Line 9B is coming through. We could block it. I mean, if we stop the tar sands here in Quebec, we stop it for all of Canada, because this is the only other way they could go. The only other way is north, of course, and they might try that because they're that desperate. And we'll have to stop them then. But if we could stop them here in Quebec, we would give a real blow to the whole industry because they have nowhere else to go. Keystone is gone, I think. Going east is gone, and going west is gone, and so Quebec is really the only one that's left, unless they go north. And I think if we get our act together and are aware of what's going on, we could stop it. But it means we have to get organized, and that's going to happen, because there's stuff happening.
Yeah, and I mean, that's why it's so important to not just get organized. We need to continue to educate and to agitate so that other people get organized as well. And that's why it's so important to have programs like this tonight and have that space to bring forward this type of analysis, because we have to recognize the corporate media is never going to, you know, bring forward this analysis. It goes against everything that's in their interest. And so it's really important that we support independent media that allows for critical analysis to come out so that more people can get educated to the realities so that they can transform and take action as well.
So now we talk a lot about the environment today, and I think that even my understanding of the environment is very capitalistic in the sense that it's about resources and about what we have and we don't have and what we can sell and what we cannot. And I want to ask you if you have like an alternative ideology about how we can actually view the environment, and maybe that would be the first step to actually changing and creating a social movement. As opposed to talking about like a carbon credits, because that in itself is an extremely capitalistic structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Sudbury, and this is a region that's heavily mined. And so, you know, my relationship to the environment was one where it was, you know, very normalized from a very young age that we, you know, we rape from the earth for our own benefit, and
you know, who cares about the mess that we create? It's all about the immediate gains. I live in an urban center where it's very much that same mentality. So I'm not very much exposed to, you know, other ways of understanding the environment and the relationship. I know when I had the privilege of being in Brazil, I was with the Guarani indigenous people who live in Paraná, in a very untouched region, very remote. That's actually a huge carbon offset project for Chevron and GM. And, you know, their relationship to the environment was completely different because every single, you know, plant had a purpose and every tree. And there was a very symbiotic relationship where they felt very humbled to give to the earth as the earth gave to them. And, you know, it was very foreign to me because it wasn't kind of like flighty, flaky hippie talk. Like we might understand it or how it might be something that we might understand in North America. It was something very genuine and very real. And I haven't had many experiences in my life where that kind of real relationship, symbiotic relationship with the earth happens in North America, because I think our societies really work hard to take that relationship away. You know, I remember years ago reading like Adbusters. I don't know if you guys remember Adbusters, you know, where they had that like a really scary statistic about seventh graders who they did this test where they showed a bunch of symbols of logos of corporations, and the kids could identify like 100 of them, right? Just by visually seeing them once. And then they did the same thing with various trees and plants. And on average, no kid can name more than 2, right? So even the ability to just identify what we understand as nature, you know, is being so limited or removed from us. How do we develop a new vocabulary or a new relationship when so many of us are living in urban centers that are so disconnected from the earth? And I think this is a really big problem that we're facing regarding the climate crisis, because if people don't feel like the environment is getting destroyed or drastically changed in detrimental ways, how do they have an empathy or a sense of urgency to move on it? And, you know, that's kind of what urban centers do, is, you know, block us out of a natural environment. So yeah, those are my thoughts on that.
All right, I had a question a little bit, a little different from, more general. But as personally speaking, and I think a lot of the people in this room, as being members of CKUT, which is an alternative media source, a lot of what we have to think about and just, you know, that drives our content is, you know, how do we not just preach to the choir? Because I know a lot of the listeners know about the issues and are very interested in the issues we cover, but we don't always reach the people who maybe need to know what's going on. As a documentary filmmaker, do you feel like you're able to expand this and expand your audience and reach more people, and especially in issues that are so pertinent as this one? And if so, how do you do that? How have you done that in the past?
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, it's a very multi-layered question. And, you know, in terms of producing content that's critical, there's all kinds of roadblocks. You know, financial limitations are a huge one, right? Like for my documentary, Myths for Profit, Canada's Role in Industries and War and Peace, I'm not necessarily going to ask the Canadian government for a grant to fund that film, you know, and they're not going to necessarily give me the money. And a Canadian broadcaster like CBC isn't necessarily going to want to touch it either. So in terms of distribution and getting the funds necessary, you know, producing radical content with, you know, analysis that it goes contrary or against the tide of capitalism and colonialism, that itself is an issue, right? So there's how do you make and how do you create the content that you want to bring forward for our movements? And for me, the answer is, the answer lies within that contradiction of our movements should be funding our own, you know, productions to bring forward that analysis. And with tools like Indiegogo and Kickstarter, we're really starting to see that happen a lot more. And I mean, on my more, I guess, pessimistic days, I am frustrated by the idea that maybe I am speaking to the so-called converted. But then I try to remember that, you know, us ourselves within the movement, it's like a salve. We need to continue to grow our analysis and understand and not feel alone in this way of thinking and continue to learn. And, you know, there's a parable I really like that I'm going to share with you. There's this woman in Ottawa, and she would go to the Eternal Flame in front of Parliament every day. And she would lay out her banner, and she would have a couple placards, and she'd have, you know, flyers there for people to take. And she had her forms of for petitions for people to sign, and she would sit there. And every day she would do this. And weeks went by, a couple months went by. And the two RCMP officers who would be there at the Eternal Flame, you know, they would see her, they worked that shift, they saw her every day. And finally, after about 2 months, they went up to her and they said, you know, no one reads your banner. No one picks up any of your flyers. No one's signing your petition. You're not changing anyone. And she looked at them and she said, you know, I'm not doing this to change you. I'm doing this so that you don't change me. And it's a parable that I get a lot of strength from, because I often do feel like I'm, you know, like talking to like my five friends, and where I'm like, yeah, we all agree, right? This is awesome. Great. But, you know, it is also something really important where I take a lot of strength from this room, and where it's just like, you know, we might not be the masses yet, but we are a strong force to be reckoned with. And we need to make tools to reinforce ourselves and keep on learning and feel more secure in our analysis as well. And, you know, I'd like to think that now with the various distribution options that are out there, you know, whether it be YouTube or, you know, people just handing DVDs or like free screenings like Cinema Politica, that who we understand as, you know, the converted is changing. Because I do know situations of people who have come up to me and validated my work by saying, I had no idea. I came here because my friend brought me, or, you know, my cousin brought me, and I wasn't interested. It doesn't affect me or touch me, and I learned so much. And I've had that experience enough that it definitely motivates me to continue, because I do believe that the more people know, they will, you know, lead to action. It will lead to action so that we can transform our societies.
So you ended your talk on the notion of hope, which I think was a really lovely way to end it. And one of my favorite subjects too that I don't think people talk about enough. I guess when I think about hope, and then when I think about the state of climate chaos, it's kind of hard to kind of parse out like a clear sense of where we're going, because you hear a lot of stats and a lot of science. And I think for a lot of regular folks, like people in this room and myself, like the science around climate change and climate chaos is a little bit hard to grasp. I mean, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. But to bring that back to the notion of hope, I'm just wondering, like, you know, we kind of tend to look at climate change as this really apocalyptic force, where some people say, you know, there's this apocalyptic strength that's looming on the horizon. Some people say it's already here. And I'm just wondering, like, I mean, maybe it's a big question, but how can you approach something like that, like climate chaos, and maintain hope, knowing that, you know, if global average temperatures go up by like 2 degrees in the next few years, that's just going to set the course of the world on like irreparable harm.
Right. Thank you for that, Aaron. I think what people have to realize is that their relationship to climate change really depends on where you are in the world. For millions of people around the world, it's not some far-off, distant problem that's coming to them. They're living it right now. The people in the Maldives, this isn't some far-off thing. Their homes are being submerged into the ocean. You know, they're having to relocate. We're already seeing masses of people having to relocate all over the world because of climate change. And so I really think it's really a matter of, you know, where you are in the world, how much it's affecting you. I would argue today's humidity is something we here in Montreal can understand as part of climate change and unusual weather for this time of year for this part of the world. You know, certainly a few months ago in Toronto when there was massive floodings, in Calgary when there was massive floodings, you know, these are real events now that are directly linked to climate change. And, you know, maybe it was Toronto a few months ago, maybe next week it's Montreal. It's, you know, for many people, it's something they're experiencing right now, and it's extremely urgent. I want to thank everyone again for coming tonight to listen to the talk, and of course all the listeners who are listening on air. Thank you so much, CQUT, for having me.
I would just like to thank Amy Miller and encourage everyone to check out undertheweather.ckut.ca. I also look up Climate Justice Montreal to get involved with them. And yeah, thank you guys so much for coming.
Thanks a lot.